and heavy feeling inside his own head. It was a soft pressure that would not go away. He realized that the thing fighting it was himself. "I'm leaving tomorrow," he thought. They had argued over who would be the one to go, and he had won. But it was bitter. He closed his eyes. "I've cut her off from me. I may never come back, and I've cut off the deepest part of me." Suddenly, Tom felt very strange and small, as if he were stranded in a dangerous place, the sole barrier between his loved ones and terrible foes. Not a superhero, but only a man, outnumbered and about to gamble all he had. As if he were himself. He opened his eyes as he felt a touch on his face. He pressed his cheek against her hand. There were still tears in her eyes, but also the beginnings of a smile. "Silly boy," he said, "you can never leave me. Haven't you realized that by now? I'll be with you and you'll come back to me." He shook his head in wonder. "Jill, I..." He started to speak, but his mouth was stopped as she pulled him down to kiss him hungrily. Her lips were hot and tender upon his, crosswise. The fingers of her right hand did insightful things. Still and all, it was the heady, sweet smell of her that made him realize that she had been right about him once again. Part 3. Dissonance. Animals are molded by natural forces they do not comprehend. To their minds, there is no past and no future. There is only the everlasting present of a single generation, its trails in the forest, its hidden pathways in the air and in the sea. There is nothing in the universe more alone than man. He has entered into the strange world of history. Lauren Isley. Chapter 28. Sout. All night he had followed them. Toward morning, Sout felt he was beginning to understand. With the dawn, the Kikwi left their nocturnal hunting grounds and swam toward the safety of their island. They stowed their woven nets and traps in hidden coral clefts, took their crude spears, and hurried from the growing light. With daytime, the killer vines would become active, and other dangers as well. By day, the Kikwi could forage the forests atop the metal islands, seeking nuts and small animals in the thick foliage. Underwater, the Kikwi looked like green puffer fish, with short, web-handed arms and flippered legs. A pair of almost prehensile ventral fins helped them maneuver. Strong, kicking legs left their hands free to carry burdens. Around each head, a fin-lined crest of wafer-thin flagelli waved, collecting dissolved oxygen to supplement each Kikwi's distended air sac. The hunter-gatherers pulled two nets full of bright, crab-like sea creatures, like multicolored metal sculptures in the mesh. The Kikwi sang a song of flutters and squawks and yelps. Sout listened as they squeaked to one another, their tiny vocabulary hardly more than a series of vocalized signals coordinating their movements. Each time a few Kikwi rose to the surface for air, the act was accompanied by a chain of complex twitters. The natives took little notice of the alien creatures that followed them. Sout kept his distance, careful not to interfere. They knew he was here, of course. Now and then the younger Kikwi would cast suspicious sonar squirts his way. Strangely, the older hunter seemed to accept him completely. Sout looked up at the growing light with relief. In spite of the darkness, he had kept his own sonar down to a minimum all night to keep from intimidating the natives. He had felt almost blind and a little panicky when he almost blundered into something. Or something almost blundered into him. Still, it had been worthwhile. He felt he had a pretty good grasp of their language now. The signal structure, like primal Delphin, was based on a hierarchical herd and the tempo of the breathing cycle. Its cause and effect logic was a bit more complicated than primal, no doubt due to hands and tool use. Look, we well hunt. Hunt, hunted, well. Careful, careful, opportunistic. Eat, eat well, will eat. Not eaten, no. Die above water, not in. Based on semantic ability alone, these creatures seemed less ripe for uplift than fallow earth dolphins had been. Others, biased toward tool-using ability, might disagree. Of course, the fact that they had hands probably meant the Kikwi would never be particularly good poets. Still, some of their braggadocio had a certain charm. The straps of Sout's harness chafed as he rose for breath. In spite of its lightweight, streamlined design, he wished he could get rid of the damn thing. Of course, these waters were dangerous, and he might need its protection. Also, Kipiru was out there somewhere, staying out of the way as requested, but listening nonetheless. Kipiru would chew Sout's dorsal fin down to the backbone if he caught him without his harness. Unlike the ultra-technical fen of Streaker's crew, Sout was uncomfortable with devices. He didn't mind computers, some of which could talk, and which helped him speak to other races, but implements for the moving, shaping, or killing of objects, these were unnatural things which he wished he could do without. He hated the two nubby little fingers at the tips of each of his pectoral fins, which they said would someday lead to full hands for his species. They were unaesthetic. He also resented the changes made to dolphin lungs, making them more resistant to land-based diseases and adapting parts to breathing oxywater. Natural cetaceans needed no such mutations. Phallo, Stenos bridonensis, and Tursiops truncatus dolphins, left untouched by the gene crafters, could outswim any of the Amicus breed almost any time. He was ambivalent to the expanded visual sense, bought at the cost of gray matter once dedicated to sound alone. Sout rose again to breathe, then submerged, keeping pace with the aboriginals. His own line represented a drive to emphasize language ability rather than tool use. It seemed to him a more natural extension of dolphin nature than all this crashing about in starships, pretending to be spacemen and engineers. That was one reason he had refused to go along in the spaceboat to help scout the derelict fleet back at the shallow cluster. Even had there been anything or anyone left to talk to, for which there'd been no evidence, he wasn't about to poke around supported only by a gang of inept clients. For Streaker to try to deal alone with the derelict fleet was like a group of children playing with a live bomb. His actions had won contempt from the crew, even though he had been vindicated by the disastrous loss of the captain's gig. Their contempt didn't matter, Sout reminded himself. He was a civilian. As long as he did his job, he didn't have to explain himself. Nor did disapproving clicks over his pursuit of Denny Sudman bother him. Long before uplift, male dolphins had been fresh with women researchers. It's a long-standing tradition, he rationalized. Whatever was good enough for horny old Flipper is good enough for his brainy descendant. One of the things he hated about Anglic patterns of thought was this need to self-justify. Men were always asking, why? What did it matter, why? There were other ways than the human way of looking at things, any whale would tell you. The Kikwi chittered excitedly as they swam toward the eastern end of their own island, preparing to hoist their catch up a crevice in the leeward seawall. Sout felt the sweep of sonar like a passing searchlight. Kipiru approached from the north to escort him back to the Earthling encampment.